Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Tux Lerzel.
This is Stephanie Domingo.
And we be drinking, we be fucking things up.
Yeah, we had some tech difficulties.
MBD, as usual. You guys don't know this, but we always have
something always.
We also be swearing.
Yes.
Technical difficulties bring that out.
So you guys, just a little behind the scenes, Tux just said, geez Louise.
I did. Drats.
That's the type of swearing that Tux be doing over here.
big facts. So welcome to the show. For those of you who don't know, Beyond Reproach is the show where we talk about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Yes.
Today we are drinking some Gin Rickeys. The Gin Ricky, weirdly enough, is one of the few classic cocktails that has a clear and well-defined origin story. The origin story is not lost to history.
Yeah.
It is not shrouded in rumors.
There aren't two people claiming it.
Yeah.
Like, no, it was me.
Yeah. This one, we know for a fact that it was invented by a bartender named George A. Williamson around 1880 at a bar called Schumacher's in D.C., It's named after a Democratic lobbyist named Colonel Joseph Kyle Rickey, also known as Joe Rickey. Joe Rickey was a regular at Schumacher's bar and didn't really like sweet drinks. Usually what he drank is basically like what we usually drink. We like to drink bourbon and soda, carbonated water and bourbon. And one day he asked this bartender at Schumacher's to add some lime juice to his cocktail. But the bartender didn't just add like a little squeeze of lime. He added a full half ounce of lime juice to his bourbon soda. And that is the birth of the bourbon Ricky. The Ricky quickly took off at Schumacher's. And before long, people were like, you know what? I love that drink, but I don't want it with bourbon. I want it with something else. And so in 1882, the recipe for the Gin Ricky first appeared in print. In 1883, these cocktails became so popular that Joe Rickey actually bought the bar.
Wow.
And owned the bar. And then he became a major lime importer into the United States.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's like, I'm going to corner the Rickey market.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. The Gin Rickey quickly surpassed the original bourbon Rickey in popularity because gin and lime go so well together.
Yeah. Was there like a rum Ricky? Because rum, I think,
you
in
could really in do lime. Any. It's basically the formula is like 4 to 6 ounces of soda water, 2 ounces of any liquor you want, and then half an ounce of lime juice. And that is a Ricky, no matter what kind of liquor you use. So you could make a vodka Ricky, a rum Ricky, whatever. Yeah.
Cool.
The Gin Ricky is the most popular and became really super popular by like the 1910s, 1920s. In fact, the book, The Great Gatsby from 1925, the Gin Ricky is named in The Great Gatsby. Tom Buchanan serves a platter of Gin Rickeys to his guests at a party.
What was the year of its origin?
It was originally invented in 1880.
So it's just like early, okay.
And then in 2011, the Ricky was declared Washington, D.C.'s official native cocktail.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that.
So more than a century after it was created, it became D.C.'s official native cocktail. Shall we take a sip?
Yeah.
Cheers.
We should cheers first.
To drunkenness.
To drunkenness.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
I love the way that you twisted the lime on top. It feels fanciful. As I go to drink it in, it just pops off. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, this is good.
Yeah.
But you added a little bit of sugar.
I added a little bit of sugar. So the original recipe called for no sugar. It's really good without sugar, but I taste tested it because when I was looking up the history of the recipe and looking for like different variations on the recipe online, a lot of bartenders were saying, add just a tiny touch of simple syrup and it helps bring out the lime juice and kind of brighten it up.
Yeah.
Sort of in the same way that like salt brightens up baked goods, sweet things.
Mm-hmm.
The sugar.
The contrast.
Yeah. The sugar brings out the acidity and the sharpness of the lime and kind of brings the lime forward.
It does taste very bright.
Yeah.
Very summery.
It was really good without the sugar. It's really not necessary if you don't want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that you guys know that we don't really like a lot of sugar in our cocktails, but you're adding like a quarter of an ounce
of simple syrup. Okay, like so just a tiny bit. Okay. Yeah.
And it really does help. So that's the gin Ricky. The only other thing that I will say is that a lot of people confuse the Ricky with the Collins. A Collins cocktail is very similar.
Yeah.
The Collins like, always calls for sugar, whereas the Ricky doesn't.
Okay.
But the main difference there is that a Collins is made with lemon juice and a Ricky is made with lime juice.
Oh, with lime juice. Okay. Yeah.
So that's really the main difference. And then the Collins always has sugar. Okay. They're very similar. Yeah. But it kind of does taste like, it tastes like a gin gimlet. If you guys like gin gimlets.
Like a watered a less sweet watered down version. Totally. Like a bubbly version.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's really good, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Soda water, lime juice, and gin. And a little tiny sugar.
Yeah. It's now a classic to me, at least. Like I think I prefer this to the gimlet.
I love a gimlet, especially in the summer. But depending on who makes it, it can be really sweet.
Yeah.
Because a lot of bartenders use that roses lime juice.
Yeah.
It tastes more like sugar than it tastes like lime.
Yes.
If you go to a good bar, though, they're making it with fresh lime juice and simple syrup. This is basically that with soda water in it.
I love it.
Yeah.
So today I am talking about Woodrow Wilson.
Really?
Oh, stop. Are you talking about Wilson too?
No, it's funny, though, because after Tim's story in the last episode, I almost did.
Okay.
I almost did. I was planning on talking about Woodrow Wilson in this episode. And then I was like, you know what? I have a story that I've been kind of sitting on, but I'm like, it can wait.
Okay. Hopefully it's not this story. I mean, maybe it is. Yeah.
even if it is, I haven't really researched it yet. Okay. I just sort of know of it.
Okay. So he's our 28th president who still holds the record for the biggest failure, presidential failure during a pandemic.
Ooh.
And it's not even close. Like, it was really, really bad. So my scandal is not about the Spanish flu, but it is worth noting up top that Wilson never publicly spoke about the pandemic.
Never.
Never.
Wow.
Even after he himself contracted the flu while in Paris negotiating the Treaty of Versailles.
Sounds strangely familiar.
He was silent about a lot of things. Between the fog of war and this massive pandemic, few were aware that Wilson got the flu, let alone had a chronic illness.
Okay.
Is this your story?
I know what you're talking about
today. Oh, okay. Damn it.
But I haven't researched it. It's funny, though. I almost did this story.
Okay.
But I didn't research it because I was like, it can wait.
My scandal this episode is about the end of Wilson's political career. When people very close to him were starting to ask questions like, are you okay, bro? Like... And the first lady rose up and told them to mind their fucking business.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So, Edith, right?
Edith, yes. Yeah. Oh, I love her. So let's raise our glasses to two things.
Okay.
To the great American tradition of lying about presidential health. But more importantly, to our first female president.
Yes.
Cue the air horns, the Jamaican air horns, Tim. Or just cue me doing that over and over again.
Please, can we just have that be the soundbite from now
on?
Oh,
God. Let me try again. Okay, cheers.
Cheers. And let's cheers again since you did two toasts. I don't need an excuse to drink twice.
Right? Take a little sippy sip.
Oh, it's so good.
So for the purpose of this story, you really don't need to know much about Wilson.
He's so boring.
He's so boring.
Yeah.
He is considered still one of our most like devout presidents. Mm-hmm. He read his Bible every single day. He was obsessed with just being good and like doing good works and was always talking about morality. So when he got to the White House, one of the first points of business was he instructed his cabinet to resegregate their offices.
Uh-huh. He played Birth of a Nation in
the
White House.
Correct.
Right? Yeah.
He was a man of contradictions. Mm-hmm. He was the first to say that the United States had a special place on the world stage. I don't know if you...
Oh, fancy.
Yeah.
Lucky us.
And he also was the first to float the idea that we should be this global police force.
But
only if needed.
Okay.
And he was actually serious about that.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, how cute. So his health struggles started 16 years before taking the office. Mm-hmm. We know this from his personal letters. He was working as a professor at Princeton, and he had his first mini stroke there.
Okay.
And it affected his right hand, like he kind of lost the dexterity in his right hand just for a few months. Like to him, it was no big deal. His wife was super concerned, but his whole thing was like, oh, I'll just write with my left hand.
Yeah.
Very poorly. Like his his handwriting is insane.
Wow.
Insane. Like I'll put pictures of it in the show notes. It looks like scribbles. Wow. Because he was just, as you'll learn, he was very sick in office.
He's like, I'm fine. My hand doesn't work, but don't worry about it. Yeah. I have another one.
Correct. Yes. Like, such a man. Like, just, that's why we have two hands. Yeah. Like, no.
If one just stops working one
it's
day.
Like, there's something.
Nothing to see here.
Ridiculous. So his doctors were telling him to slow down. He's just like, no. He was really a man on the mission. Like, yeah. He felt, after his first mini stroke, he became really, really driven. Mm-hmm. He basically cut out all of his leisure time against the recommendations of his doctors. And he kind of turned his eye to the international and, like, national stage.
Okay.
Like, he wanted to be president.
Yeah.
So that we know of, he suffered two more mini strokes while president of Princeton now. One stroke left him partially blind in his left eye.
That's why you got two eyes.
Thank you. And again, it affected his right hand for a couple of months. But in his medical opinion, he was just writing too much.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally, right?
Because
he'd be knowing. So he went from the president of Princeton to governor of New Jersey to the presidency in 10 years.
Wow.
He truly felt his mortality. So when Wilson was...
He's like, I got shit to do. Let's do this.
I mean, yeah, totally. When Wilson was inaugurated in 1913, within a year, he had another mini stroke.
Wow.
For those at home with like a scorecard, this is the fourth mini stroke. And it's now affecting his left side.
Uh-huh.
So it's on both sides of his brain.
But he's like, doctors don't know what they're talking about. I'm fine, clearly.
No. He's just tired.
Yeah. But let's not rest.
Yeah. Exactly. So he's in the White House now, and he befriended a White House doctor named Carrie Grayson. And this doctor was very, very happy to blow smoke up his ass.
I mean, if that's what he wants.
Clearly, that's what he wants. Thankfully, his wife, Ellen, had sense and took it upon herself to get, like, real medical opinions. Mm-hmm. But she died suddenly that year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she had been battling a kidney disease called Bright's disease for years.
Okay.
But the good Dr. Grayson kind of shielded Wilson from that knowledge of like how bad her condition was until it was too late. In his defense, he was afraid that he was going, like, the stress of it would make him have another mini stroke.
I see. Okay.
So
it's still fucked up. And
it is.
Poor woman. Like, yeah. I guess if there was nothing he could do.
He was in a difficult spot. So his wife, Ellen, died in August. The following March, he was set up with a wealthy widow named Edith Balling Galt.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it was a very quick romance. His biggest move was making her feel like a trusted advisor. He sent romantic letters that peppered in questions about political matters. Like, he was always asking her for her opinion on such and such.
A woman with a brain, huh?
Correct.
Wow.
The timing of their romance made for very juicy rumors. Mm-hmm. There was a rumor that they together killed Ellen. Or that they were having an affair.
Yeah.
Which was absurd because literally he just met her.
Yeah.
Like, it was 3 months they had known each other.
And how much earlier had the first wife died before they met?
She died in August. They met in March.
Okay. But that's still, like, that's several months. I mean, it's not a lot of time. But it's not a lot of time. It's not like the wife died and then he met this other woman, like, 2 days later.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's not like that. But it was kind of absurd because he didn't know her. They weren't having an affair.
Sure. Okay.
He was having an affair with another woman.
Of course.
For several.
Sure. Okay.
He was having an affair with a woman named Mary Peck for several years. I don't want to get into it, but his late wife, was really sick for a while and she was like kind of depressed.
Sure.
So instead of, comforting her, he's just like, I'll just find another.
Yeah. I mean, who needs a depressed woman when you could have someone that's not sick and depressed?
When Wilson proposed to Edith, his inner circle basically flipped the fuck out.
Okay.
For good reason. Like, he had just met this woman. It had been 3 months and he had proposed.
Yeah.
And he was trusting this stranger with all this, like, kind of confidential information.
The man's on a fast track. He's got shit to do and a limited time to do it. So
yeah. But he was up for re-election that following year. And just the optics of him quickly, like, finding another wife.
I wonder if maybe he was worried about the optics of an unmarried president, too, though. Because at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, being a widower.
Yeah, his cousin was staying with him after his wife died, just in the White House. They called her, like, a surrogate first lady.
what's his name? Groper Cleveland had his sister because he was unmarried.
Yeah.
And then he had his child bride that he was waiting for her to grow up.
So,
sorry.
So Groper actually was in my earlier outline because one of his doctors was also Groper's doctor. Did you know that Groper was secretly sick for a time?
All right.
But this doctor was telling him like, dude, you're fucking sick. And he's like, no, I'm not trying to hear that.
Yeah.
He's just like, no, I'm in love, basically. So they decided to get a little sneaky. They faked some love letters between Wilson and Mary, the woman that he actually was previously having an affair with.
Okay.
And he was going to leak them to the press in hopes that this would cause like a very like shameful.
Wilson's advisors did this or opponents?
Advisors to get rid of Edith. They thought that if they leaked these notes to the press, it would kind of knock him down a peg in their mind. Like, he's not this amazing man that you think he is.
What a weird way to, like, you're concerned sabotage. About the optics of him having a girlfriend exactly. after his wife died. So let's release some information about him cheating on his wife while she was sick.
Yeah.
That's the way to solve it? What the fuck is wrong with you?
They didn't really think their plan through. But they did write these phony letters and they did leak them to the press. And when the news broke, Wilson basically ran to Edith and like confessed. And it's like, dude, your shit's already out here. Like, why are you even confessing?
Yeah.
And he suggested that she should back out of their engagement.
Okay.
To protect her honor.
Okay.
Which is like,
she had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
I guess that she would marry a man that
is like disgrace.
On his previous wife.
It's such a weird plan of sabotage. But Edith instead said, like, let's just get married next year.
Okay.
Let's wait a full year. You can have your like mourning period and then we'll get married. So he had like found his like ride or die. She's just like,
sure, we're not going to tell anyone what's going on. The public won't know
exactly
that we're waiting, but yes, we're waiting.
But we're waiting.
Okay. That sounds like a good plan, but like, why didn't the fucking advisor just come and be like, hey, why don't you just wait?
They didn't like her. I can't defend their actions other than they really, really did not like this woman.
Okay.
So,
because she had a brain.
Yes.
And she also had a vagina.
She had like drive. And well, I'm going to get into like who she was. So the second Mrs., she was born to a really poor family in Virginia.
Okay.
Her family had been previously really, really wealthy because they owned a plantation prior to the Civil War, but then when they had to pay for labor and pay for property taxes, they were instantly broke. Like, broke is a joke, like, broke.
Like, Brokey McPoverty.
They were Brokey McPoverty. So her dad had to get a job for the first time, and he decided to be a lawyer, and he was not good.
Yeah, okay.
She didn't have a lot of formal education. She learned to read and write at home.
Okay.
But she also was taught the Lost Cause mythology at home by her grandmother.
Of course she was.
Yeah.
She was raised in, what'd you say, Virginia?
Virginia.
Yeah.
Of course
she was.
Near the Appalachians. Like, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
She actually was sent to finishing school, but within a month she came home because her dorm was too cold.
Girl.
I don't know. I didn't look too much into it, but I'm like, did her dad send her to some like Brokey McPoverty like finishing school, like a really shitty one, or was she just a princess?
It sounds like it could be either or both.
She comes home and she decides that she's just going to go to D.C. Her older sister was already in D.C., so she kind of followed her there. And she was really beautiful.
The other sister?
No, Edith.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
She was really young and really beautiful. So instantly she married a wealthy older man when she got to D.C.
Okay.
She married a man who was the heir to the largest and oldest jewelry store in D.C.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
Zales? Not Zales, everyone.
Not Zales.
Mr. Zales.
She was not a Zales like heiress. So she was married to this man for 12 years, and he died suddenly when he was 43.
43?
Like really young, died suddenly.
Wow.
So she was left with like bags and bags of coins as like a young woman.
Yeah, wow.
And so she decided to tour Europe. She got really into Parisian haute couture.
Ooh, yes.
Ooh la la. Ooh la la is right. So she came back to D.C. dripping, as the kids say. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. She had that drip. She
gross.
What?
No, it just sounds gross.
It's
Yeah. I know what you mean.
You know what? Yes. Okay. I'm like, do I have to explain drip?
Nope. I got it.
So she was the first woman in D.C. to buy and drive her own car.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So she was on some like hot girl shit in like a fancy car, of course.
Damn, she's that bitch.
She's that bitch, yes. She's 100% that bitch.
Wow. I like her. Hot, smart, drive.
Has her own money. Like and all of it in a car. Yeah. I'm thinking this is why these hated men her. Hated
it
her.
It makes absolute sense right? that they hated her.
Right? Yeah. They were just beside themselves.
100%. She's like the Cardi B.
Exactly. Exactly. Despite this, despite the fact that she was amazing in every way, she was completely snubbed by DC elites.
Wow. Okay.
They considered her, quote, trade.
Trade
because her husband
was working class, quote unquote,
even got his money from a retail store.
Sure. Yeah.
So like she was beneath them.
Okay. Trade meaning something else than
what yeah.
I'm like, she was trade?
I knew you were gonna be like, yeah. huh?
Yeah, wow. Okay, I get it now. I get yeah. what you're saying.
The fact that her late husband like worked for his living, for his money. Like how
yeah.
gauche.
Yeah. Nouveau riche.
So this his advisors, you know, they tried to scare her off, but she was not, you know, she was not at all threatened by them. She's just yeah. like, whatever. But
she's like, fuck you. I'm that bitch.
Exactly. And she would remember like how these guys tried her. And this is going to come yeah. back later.
Okay.
I mean, I think that they were afraid that she could potentially manipulate him in his like frail state.
I mean.
Anyway, so when they married. So they got married, and within a year of their marriage, his health was failing.
Sure.
He's just a man on a mission, refusing to rest, like doing literally all of the wrong things. Mm-hmm. But he's still continuing his denial
yeah.
because it's working, and no one's really looking at him. Well, no one's looking too hard at him.
Okay.
Because yeah. the country's inching towards war, and there's a pandemic. There were rumors that he was sick in the press. Like, I will put some in the show notes, but no one was, like, nothing really stuck.
Yeah.
Because there were bigger issues at hand. So he won his second term, and he led the country in directly into World War I, basically.
Okay.
By then, Edith rarely left his side. I like to call them Woodreedith, because they were like, it took me a while. Like, I need to do, like, a Bennifer
yeah,
situation.
Yeah.
I like... Wow, I just showed my age.
Who?
When J-Lo and Ben Affleck were dating, yeah. their Gigli period.
Yeah. You know Brad and Jen.
What was the biggest?
Is it Brangelina?
Exactly.
But Brad, yeah, that's why I was saying Brad yeah. and Jen, because that was before Brangelina.
Ah, okay. I see what you
I'm
did
trying
there.
To make myself appear even more decrepit. Brittle bones.
So, Wajrita, they worked together.
I love that.
They worked together in this private office upstairs. Like, he wasn't even working in the Oval Office. Like, he had his own private quarters.
Okay.
Where they were just working together. He gave her access to classified documents.
Wow.
She had secret wartime codes.
Damn. Okay.
Woodrow let Edith screen his mail and later his visitors. The first lady sat in on cabinet meetings. Afterwards, she gave, like, her hot takes about who was in the meeting. Like her personal feelings about mm-hmm. people and like what they said. So as the war was heating up, she started to limit his calls.
She's like, that guy's a turd. You don't even need to talk to him.
It's hard to know like why she did that.
Sure, of
course, possible yeah. that he was just getting like kind of stressed and like therefore kind of sick.
Yeah, like don't worry about it. This one isn't as
yeah.
important as it.
I mean, it could be either or.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be a mix of both too. But she alone decided when the president could and could not be disturbed.
Okay.
So soon his most trusted advisor and his loyal press secretary, like these men who tried to play her, were just being shut out. It's like, wow. This is what you get when you try to like sloppily sabotage someone in full view of them. So spring 1919, Woodreedith, they were in Paris. Woodrow was there to negotiate the end of the war. He went there armed with his 14-point strategy for achieving world peace. Do you know anything about his...
Bits yeah. and pieces.
I know a lot about it, but it's not super relevant
yeah.
to the story. But I found this Washington Post article that kind of gives an overview in broad strokes. They said that this plan called for open and transparent peace treaties, freedom and self-determination for all European nations, disarmament, and above all, the creation of a General Association of Nations, which was later called the League of Nations.
Yeah.
And the League of Nations, their purpose was to actively prevent all world wars.
They clearly did a really good job of that.
Yeah. But this was Woodrow Wilson's like brainchild. This yeah. was like his baby.
Okay.
He went there being like, okay, I got the solution to the mm-hmm. problem. Like he was an idealist. And the 14-point plan was actually really amazing, but...
Yeah, I mean, he's complicated because he's
yeah.
he was trying to do some really good things, but he was also
again
racist POS.
Like I said, a man of contradictions.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had this plan, but his friends basically hated it. Like, Great Britain and France torpedoed his 14 points.
Yeah.
Like, weren't backing him up at all. The French especially, they wanted all of the blood. All of the blood. Like, the prime minister wanted billions and billions in reparations. Dude wanted to,
from Germany.
From Germany.
Yeah.
He wanted to, turn out the pockets of, several generations of German citizens for the loss of French lives and businesses.
Okay.
Property, you know?
So if we had adopted this 14-point plan, we might never have gotten into World War II in the first place.
How dare you? That was my closing statement.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Yeah, but literally, yeah. Hitler came to power because Germany Correct. Was broken with poverty
yes.
because of
the And they were so embarrassed. Like, this whole thing was humiliating. Yeah. I mean, I'll get to it at the end, I guess.
I'm sorry.
But it's all right. No, it's worth saying, I sort of reverse engineered this whole scandal so I could talk about that at the end. So it's all right.
Okay. I've taken the wind out of your sails.
No, it's still a good scandal and it's fine to talk about it here. Wilson wanted to spare Germany this massive humiliation.
Yeah.
He just kind of wanted to look forward and just punish Germany a little bit, but yeah. just keep it moving.
Okay.
When the conference deadlocked, this is when he got the flu. On the night of April 3rd, Wilson became violently ill with a crazy cough and 103-degree fever.
Wow.
Really, really sick. He got so sick so quickly that Dr. Grayson, who went with him everywhere with good reason, thought he had been poisoned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the Spanish flu was no fucking joke.
Do you know about the Spanish flu?
I know little bits and pieces.
Do you know that it was worse for young, healthy people?
Oh, he did not know that.
Yes.
Wow.
So the fact that Wilson had an immune system not worth a bag of dicks because dicks are disposable was preventative for him.
Okay.
Because in normal healthy people, it caused this overreaction of the immune system.
Oh.
So your healthy lungs would just be flooded with fluid and you would essentially drown within days. Healthy young people.
I did not know that. Yeah.
I want to go back to the Spanish flu because it's crazy.
Hashtag History did a little mini episode mm-hmm. about the Spanish flu when coronavirus yeah. first came. And they say that it's possible that Germany would have won World War I if so many people on the front hadn't gotten the Spanish flu. So they lost so many soldiers to the flu that they think that that's what lost them the war.
Yeah. 5 times more Americans died of the flu than on the battlefield.
That's crazy.
And it was like that globally. So he was sick in bed for 5 days. No one saw him for 5 days. During this time, Edith and Dr. Grayson were doing their best damage control, just going around telling these world leaders, oh, he's just tired. He's just resting. He's fine. Yeah. Don't worry. It's nothing more than a bad cold, they said. So no one knew at the time that he was sick. They just thought he looked like shit and was acting crazy when he got back.
Okay.
Because he had a side effect that was really, really common with people who survived the flu. It was a temporary psychosis.
Wow.
Yeah. I've actually had temporary psychosis post a really terrible bout of sickness that I had 3 years ago. I was seeing things. It was crazy. But it was days after my fever had gone down. So
I didn't realize that. I knew that you'd been sick, but I thought it was while you had the fever.
It was both.
Wow.
Yeah. It was about, they got my fever under control and 4 days later it stopped.
Wow.
Yeah. I was having hallucinations for 8 days. It was bad. But yeah, it gave me great perspective. I'm just anyone can be crazy. And it's really just brain chemistry.
Damn.
So he came back to the conference and was really paranoid. He thought that there were these French spies all over, that they were following him. He started being really preoccupied with furniture and his automobiles.
Weird.
He just started talking to people about the cars that he drove in D.C. And people are just what the fuck is wrong with
They're
you?
So how about this treaty? Blah, blah, blah.
He's yeah.
Oh, you know about my cars?
Yeah. And look at that table over there. ooh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Damn, that sucks. I mean, that's awful that
yeah.
it was psychosis.
There was a quote from his chief usher that said that he was bizarrely obsessed with his furniture and his automobiles, and pretty much everyone around him noted it. He went on to say that something queer was happening in the president's mind, and that one thing is certain, he was never the same after this little bout of sickness.
Never the same. Wow, that's awful.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the British prime minister and resident mean girl was calling him out. in heated debates over just being so disoriented and kind of weird, he said that Wilson was suffering a nervous and spiritual breakdown, like wow. in front of everyone in the middle of debating the Treaty of Versailles. So it was a mess. His yeah. like allied homies were kind of like reading him, and no one was on his side because he wasn't really able to articulate his 14 points uh-huh. because he was sick.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, he didn't have like the will or the strength to really advocate for this plan that he went there to, yeah. you know, accomplish. In the end, he caved on 13 of the 14 points.
13?
Yeah, all except for the League of Nations.
Shit, okay.
Damn. When Widredith got home, when they got back home, people were fucking pissed.
Yeah.
Because he had been talking up this 14-point plan, and he came back with a one-point plan.
Uh-huh.
It looked really bad. Yeah, there were a lot of high-profile, like really fiery resignations. Like, I'll put some in the show notes. Like, just people basically saying that he's weak.
Yeah. How dare he have an illness?
Well, they didn't know.
They didn't know.
And plus, there were a lot of German citizens at the time. And like the fact that it was so punishing on Germany like yeah. wasn't a good look.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a lot of people were just really fucking pissed at him. And despite his like really declining, like rapidly declining health, he went on this like public speaking tour to really just promote the remaining point of his plan, the League of Nations. So he went on this train tour out west. He didn't get very far.
Uh-huh.
Within a few weeks, he had collapsed at a stop in Colorado. This was on September 25th. So the train had to like speed back to D.C. And on October 2nd, Edith found her husband unconscious on the bathroom floor.
Oh, my God.
So, of course, she calls for Dr. Grayson, and the two of them like lifted him back into bed. And yeah, he had suffered a massive stroke this time that left him fully paralyzed on his left side. And his left eye was completely blind.
Okay.
It was the big one.
He's got two.
Yeah.
He's got two eyes. It's fine.
So they both agree that it was best to create like a barrier between the president and anyone else. They didn't want anyone to see him in this really compromised, like feeble state.
Yeah.
He was unable to speak more than a few words. He couldn't write anything. He couldn't write his name even. Edith decided that she was going to continue his administration by any means necessary.
Okay.
The first move in what her memoirs called her stewardship.
Ooh.
Yes. Was just to lie and mislead the entire world. Yeah.
Okay.
She lied to the cabinet, the Congress, people, the press, foreign dignitaries. Like anyone could catch these lies. Like yeah. just lies, lies, lies.
She wouldn't be the first, and she yeah. was certainly not the last.
She, together with the good Dr. Grayson, they crafted this massive, massive disinformation campaign,
wow.
complete with like fake, like phony medical records that they would release to the press.
Holy
they
shit.
Got like other doctors to release this shit. Like it was bad. She would only permit a vague acknowledgement. This is from I think an Atlantic article. She would only permit a vague acknowledgement that Wilson badly needed rest and would be working from his bedroom suite.
Okay.
That was as far as they would go to say that he was, you know, he was ill.
Yeah. Okay.
So when cabinet members like tried to see Wilson, like they tried to like put the whites of their eyes on him, they got no further than Edith. She yeah. was the gatekeeper. She
sure.
was the goalie playing incredible defense.
Yeah.
If they had policy papers or decisions for him to review, edit, or approve, she would look over them first. Then she would decide if she thought the matter was pressing enough. If it was pressing, then she would take it to her husband into his personal chamber,
mm-hmm.
close the door, and then she'd read the documents to him.
Okay.
So this is how she described the process. This is from her memoirs. So I began my stewardship. I studied every paper sent from the different secretaries or senators and tried to digest and present in tabloid form the things that, despite my vigilance, had to go to the president. I myself never made a single decision regarding the disposition of public affairs. The only decision that was mine was what was important and what was not, and the very important decision of when to present matters to my husband.
If she didn't see something as important, what would she do? She would just tell the people like...
To wait.
Okay.
To wait until it got better.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Come back later. It was a very awkward way to run a government.
Yeah.
And people weren't having it. I mean... They went through the process, like they were waiting in the West sitting room hallway while she talked privately with the president. She would return their paperwork with like scribbles in the margins that were often like really illegible. She said that that was like, He was writing notes.
Okay.
But it's in bad handwriting because he's so sick.
Okay.
So a lot of people are like, is this the handwriting of a sick president or like a nervous caretaker?
Yeah.
We don't know. But she said that these were the president's verbatim responses.
Okay.
Despite pleas from advisors, she would not consider letting her husband step down and letting the vice president take over.
Yeah.
That would only, she said, depress her Wilson, who was already in a fragile state.
Aww.
Dr. Grayson, he played his part of Team Lies as the co-captain of Team Lies. He was very quick because everyone was coming to him.
Yeah.
Because the president is clearly not feeling well. So it's like, you go to the doctor and you ask what's wrong. So he said that the president's mind was not only clear, but very active. All that was inflicting Woodrow Wilson was a touch of indigestion and a depleted nervous system.
He can't see you. He has heartburn.
Exactly. When Dr. Grayson briefed the cabinet, which he did often because they were just like, dude, what the fuck is going on? Yeah. Like, what is really going on?
Yeah.
He stuck to his story. He refused to sign any official notice of disability, which is what they wanted him to do, so that the vice president could take over. He just, you know, he kept to his story. The president was tired and gassy.
Who isn't?
Thank you.
I myself am currently tired and gassy.
Same. Thankfully, there were no major issues during the 17-month period between October 1919 and March 1921 when Edith was, like, you know, running the state. A lot of people referred to the First Lady, like, this period of time when she basically had all the power as, like, her regency, kind of sarcastically. Never to her face, but sure, but there were a few spicy moments, like when Edith heard that the Secretary of State had a cabinet meeting without the president. And I'm like, meeting her?
Yeah. She's like,
okay. She considered it an act of insubordination.
Yeah.
And later, when Wilson was feeling better, he forced him to resign.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So he was kind of like fired because of her.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
So, yeah.
I mean, it was very irregular, and I understand why he would be like, no, we're going to continue having a government now.
Yeah.
But.
So, as the president's condition improved, Edith was still playing, like, extreme defense. When Republican Senator Albert Fall was sent by Congress to investigate the president's true condition, she accepted his request. Do you remember Albert Fall?
I was going to say that name sounds very
familiar.
Teapot
Dome.
That's right. Yeah, I knew him from somewhere.
If you guys have listened to episode 9, you know that Albert Fall should be investigating his own damn self because he was selling off interior land to oil companies, like oil reserves meant for the army. He was selling them to the highest bidder. So fuck you. So she allowed him. She was given time to, like, get herself together and, like, present the best picture of health that she could. She
put some makeup on him so he didn't look blue.
Yes. She kind of did, like, a Weekend at Bernie's.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he was working from his bed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she had him in his bed. She had his bad arm covered. Uh-huh. She, like, shaved his mangy beard. She had, like, perfect lighting, and she was sitting right by his side the whole time.
So she would, like, shake his head for, like, nod.
I mean, not like that.
She had her hand up the back of his shirt.
Like a ventriloquist dummy. Yeah.
She's over here like, oh, that sounds great.
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, that's hilarious. But basically, so Wilson was able to get through this meeting. It was only about 15 minutes. But, like, he left being like, okay, I guess the president's alive. But the biggest scandal that happened during her reign was, this is so, God, it's so petty. The First Lady, she insisted that a lowly British embassy aide be fired because he made a joke about her.
Okay.
She said that if this person wasn't fired, she threatened to refuse the clearance of an ambassador who came from London specifically to help negotiate Wilson's version of the League of Nations. Like, he came there to basically be Wilson in Congress, like, pushing for this league.
Yeah. And, like, she's just, do the things that Wilson would have wanted.
Exactly. Wow. But she's just like, no, if you're not going to fire this, like, peon aide, then I'm going to refuse your clearance. And he's just like, fuck off. And he went back to London.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, like, she fucked that up. She, like, messed up the one thing that the president had been busting his ass for, giving himself strokes for.
Yeah.
And it was gone because The Congress didn't ratify the treaty. They refused to sign the Treaty of Versailles, and they refused to take part in League of Nations.
Damn.
So petty. It's like, bitch, you're the president. Like, this level of petty should be so far beneath you, it should be fucking invisible.
Well, I think the she was like, I am president. I deserve respect.
But if you're president, like, who cares?
I know.
You have all the power. Like, fuck this dude.
It's really fucked up to say that, like, it's 19 something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 1919.
Like, you should expect men to just be pieces of shit and, like, yeah, just move on with your day.
Exactly.
But
it's like, oh, a man was a man?
Exactly, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
The fact that she really wanted this guy so badly fired that she was willing to just jeopardize what her husband was pushing for is just beyond me.
Yeah.
It sucks. Until her death in 1961, the former First Lady, she insisted that she never fully assumed the power of the presidency,
mm-hmm,
which only meant that she was smart enough not to snitch on herself.
Sure.
Because that's illegal. You have to be elected to be president. So,
but that's literally what she had done.
Yeah.
She was the president.
There were 17 months, and it's hard to say if she was the
17 months?
Oh, yeah. From October 1919 to March 1921.
Well, her husband is literally Weekend at Bernie's, and she's like, yay or nay. Like,
and just like scribbling notes. Yeah. We know that she fucking wrote some of them.
Yeah.
We don't have proof that she did, is what I will say. But during that time, she was definitely acting president for some, if not most, of that time. And there's a lot of evidence to support that. So Wilson's disability remained a secret until after his death on February 3rd, 1924. And it was used as a rationale for passing the 25th Amendment.
Okay.
It laid out what must be done if the president is, quote, unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which we're talking about. Well, we have been talking about using, but we're not going to do it.
Yeah. So the end. But I was just going to say aside that, you know, I kind of reverse engineered this whole thing just to talk about the Treaty of Versailles. Many historians agree that one of the main causes of the rise of Hitler's Nazi Party was the humiliation and economic desperation caused by the treaty.
Yeah.
This whole League of Nations was supposed to be there to prevent future wars.
Sure.
And many people now argue that Wilson's mental and physical health during the negotiations played a major role.
Of course.
Yeah. There's no way to prove that if, you know, Wilson hadn't folded like the cheapest of cheap suits in Paris, that there would be no Hitler, but it's something worth thinking about. I mean, yes, she kind of fucked up, but he fucked up first.
You cannot say it is only her fault.
Oh, obviously. Absolutely not. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't just unequivocally say she is the reason that Hitler came to power.
Like, no. Obviously. She fucked up the last part.
She fucked up one part of a long series of fuck ups.
Exactly.
And it's possible that even if he hadn't fucked up things and if he hadn't been sick in the first place, it still might not have gone through because England and France were fucking pissed and wanted vengeance.
They wanted gallons and gallons of blood and billions in reparations.
And all them fucking sales jewels.
Yeah.
But like the German ones.
Yeah, it's hard to know. But I just thought the story was interesting.
It's
right.
I loved it.
Isn't it fun? Wasn't it fun?
Yes. That was really great. Now I have to talk.
Yeah.
I don't want to. I'm tired and gassy.
If only you had like two bodies with two different digestive systems. Yeah.
I wish my husband could come just put his arm up my back and tell my story for me. Oh, okay. Let's go make another drink.
Yes.
That was so good. Thank you.
Wasn't that fun?
Yeah, that was really fun. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Natalie.
And I'm Cass.
And we're the hosts of Shared History,
a comedic history podcast exploring the stories of the often overlooked or underrepresented.
The people and events your history books may have glossed over, whitewashed, man-washed, or left out completely.
From the Mayan creation myth to the deaf president now movement of the 1980s.
From ancient scientist Avicenna to first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller.
If you saw it in a footnote once,
or have never heard of it,
we are here to share it with you.
Join us in a rotating guest list featuring scholars, writers, teachers, entertainers, entrepreneurs, subject matter experts, and more.
Tune in to Shared History on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, you know the drill.
And follow us at SharedPod on Instagram and Twitter.
And as always,
share you later.
We are back with Fresh Cocktails. This is so good. Like, this is my new... I think it's a little more summery than, like, winter appropriate,
definitely.
But it's still good in the winter.
Yeah, I mean, it's not stopped me from drinking it.
A lot of it. I will, but this will be, like, my favorite summer cocktail.
This
replaces the gimlet as my favorite summer
cocktail.
This
replaces the gin and tonic for me.
Mm.
It just goes down so nice.
Yeah. In recent years, I should say that the margarita has replaced the gimlet as my favorite summer cocktail. But now...
Oh, you like the margarita so much.
Like a good homemade margarita or made by a bartender who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
A margarita with sour mix is not worth drinking.
No, it isn't.
But a margarita with real lime juice can be so good. And I usually make them myself, especially in the summer.
No, yours are very good. I've had your watermelon margarita and it's too good.
Ooh, can you imagine some watermelon in this? See? Replacing the margarita as this favorite summer cocktail. Yeah.
I like how bubbly it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel strong, which is... okay, your face is telling me that it is strong.
this is a big glass. That's all I'm going to say. I've had to increase the volume of this cocktail to fill this glass.
Okay. As I take a sip of regular water.
That's a good idea. Okay. I guess I should talk about... my story today. I should say some things. Today, I am finally getting around to talking about McCarthyism.
Ooh.
Yes. If you are a longtime listener, you will know that we have brought up McCarthyism several times in the past, and I have said several many times that I want to talk about McCarthyism, but I just didn't know how to do it because McCarthyism is a big story.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of people involved. And it spans like over a decade of time. So I just wasn't quite sure like what the best way to attack it was. And I think that I finally figured it out. I'm going to talk about the effects of McCarthyism on Hollywood.
I salute you for even trying.
Yes. I have a feeling I'm probably going to have to go back to McCarthyism at least once, if not twice.
I have that same feeling.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Yes.
There is a lot going on. For those of you who don't already know, McCarthyism refers to a period that starts in the late 1940s and goes through the end of the 1950s when America was going through a second Red Scare. And even the most baseless accusations and most nonsensical rumors of communist ties or ties to the USSR could quite literally ruin someone's life. Today, the term McCarthyism actually refers more to these sort of like damn you, gin rickies.
No.
This refers today more to these unsubstantiated accusations and sort of attacks on people's character and attacks on their patriotism than it does to the actual rooting out of communist ties or ties to the USSR. So today I would like to propose a toast.
Ooh, yes.
Raise your glass to smear campaigns and to the knowledge that in politics, fear and misinformation are much more powerful tools than facts or evidence.
I don't want to cheers to this, but I got to.
Them's the rules. So before I can really get into this story, I do need to kind of lay down some background information, quite a bit of background information, because this is a big story.
I'm just going to shut my damn mouth.
And first, before I can even lay down background information, I need to put things into perspective. To start with, you have to think about the 1930s. In the United States, we were going through the Great Depression, this crazy economic depression where, like, a lot of people were not just, like, struggling, but destitute.
Yeah.
Completely fucking destitute.
Yeah.
And people were freaking out about, like, what's the best way forward for this country when everyone is Poe.
This is before the safety net.
Yes, absolutely. And at the same time that this is happening, we are also witnessing and watching the rise of fascism in Europe. Thanks to fucking Edith Wilson.
She's not here to defend herself, but she's sorry.
During this period, thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans started joining the Communist Party of, well, it was called Communist Party USA, which you have to keep in mind, I should say, this is a separate party, its own American Communist Party. Mm. There's not really like a significant tie to the Soviet Union. We're not like, Americans are not like, you know what would be fun? Let's be Soviet communists. You know what I mean? That's not what was going on. But a lot of people didn't really understand that nuance and just thought, these people are fucking communists. What is going on over here? But it's because they were going through this economic depression. They're like, clearly capitalism isn't working. What do we do? Mm-hmm. Then we get into the 1940s. Towards the end of the 1940s, World War II is over. The USSR is no longer our ally. We're entering the Cold War. We are witnessing nations in Eastern Europe are starting to fall to Soviet domination. We're also entering the Korean War, or about to enter the Korean War.
Mess.
And we have just found out that the USSR has gotten its hands on the nuclear blueprints and is about to start testing nuclear weapons. And we were freaked the fuck out. Justifiably so. Nuclear weapons are no joke. We shouldn't have been testing them either, but that's another story that we've already discussed.
Yes.
Multiple times.
I don't want to talk about it.
So at this point, kind of like 46, 47, communism is a boogeyman again. And a lot of politicians are running around claiming that there are these like treasonous government employees working within the United States government who are also working for the Soviets and selling them information, selling them our secrets. Mm. And that's how they got the nuclear blueprints.
It sounds like these people have high fevers.
Yeah. I mean, Soviet spies. That it's not to say that there were not any Soviet spies. It was a serious problem, but it wasn't as rampant as they made it out to be. There weren't as many spies as they made it out to be. So the term McCarthyism is named after a Republican senator from Wisconsin named Joseph McCarthy. He was responsible for this series of communist witch hunts and sham trials and hearings that he conducted using the power of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Basically, he held these hearings against anyone with leftist leanings. You didn't have to be a communist. You didn't have to be a former communist if he thought that you didn't fall in line behind his conservative politics. You could be a victim. McCarthy himself was actually only involved in McCarthyism from like 1950 through about 1954. His involvement really ramped up in like 52, peaked in 1953, and then kind of fell apart in 54. But McCarthy really took things to the next level. Before he got involved, people were already trying to like prosecute communist spies and communists working in the government. But he's the one that really made these hearings super sensational and super like tabloid fodder. So a lot of historians think that what we call McCarthyism should actually be called Trumanism, because President Harry Truman set this whole thing into place when he was trying to prove to the American public that he took the threat of communism seriously.
I hate Truman so much.
He's a turd. So in 1947, he signed this executive order that required millions of federal employees to sign a loyalty oath. And it screened these millions of employees for any affiliation with organizations deemed, quote, totalitarian, fascist, communist, or subversive, or advocating to alter the form of government of the United States by unconstitutional means. Of 2.5 million federal employees that were screened, like 5,500 people went before hearings.
Okay.
Of those people.
I can't believe they screened that many people.
2.5 million people.
What weak shit is that? That you're so afraid that 2.5 million people, you find 5,000 of them?
Like a pittance.
Yeah.
Of 5,500. So then 5,500 went before hearings. Most of those people were cleared. Then they were left with 332 people.
Wow, it's like voter fraud.
Yeah. And then of those 332, 102 were fired. And they don't. We don't even know for sure that all of those 102. I mean, if there were 102 Soviet spies working for the United States government, that's a big deal. But we don't know that that's actually what was going on. We just couldn't. Those 102 people could not prove that they weren't communists. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it didn't really matter.
Exactly.
It's a political party.
Yeah.
You're allowed to join a political party.
You should be.
No one. Yeah. Exactly.
It feels like Salem.
Things started to change in 1950 because Joseph McCarthy was up for re-election in Wisconsin. He had done some things and it didn't look like he was going to win his re-election.
Yes.
So he's like, okay, I need to rally support. What can I use? What can I use to do this?
Oh, can I use fear?
Yes. Fear and intimidation. Communism was going to be his golden ticket. So in February of 1950, he holds a campaign speech, a rally, and he's talking about communist sympathizers working in the State Department. And throughout the course of the speech, he holds up a piece of paper and he's like, looky here. I have here.
I'm just picturing like Willy Wonka.
Literally. I got a golden ticket. Yeah.
He's like skipping home.
His grandpa is like in the bed behind him.
His whole family's in the bed.
Communism. Fizzy lifting. Oh, man. So he holds up this piece of paper. It blows up into the air exhaust because of the fizzy lifting drink.
Oh, man.
So he says, I have here in my hand a list of 205 that were known to the Secretary of State as being members of the Communist Party and who nevertheless are still working and shaping the policy of the State Department. 205 people, he's making this accusation. He has this list of names. However, I need another sip. I can't speak with it. I can't speak without it. So I'm just going to let my... wet my whistle, loosen my jaw gums.
Yes.
So his secretary later came out and was like, you know what? Those were his speech notes. He didn't have no fucking list of names. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. By this point, that he had already pulled the wool over everybody's eyes.
It's so upsetting how it never matters.
It didn't matter. The very next day after he made the speech, 33 newspapers across the country were reporting on this list of 205 names. And then when he went back to Washington, he just keeps repeating this claim. There are 205 people in the State Department that, should be fired because they have communist ties. But he wouldn't release any detail. He wouldn't release any names. He has a list of names, but he can't tell you what they are.
He can't tell you.
Yeah. Not only did this tactic work to win him his reelection, it also won him fanatical nationwide support. People were sending in fucking fan letters. At one point, he was getting 5,000 letters a day from people that are like, yeah, fuck communists. Throughout the 1950s, he starts to launch these investigations into communists who are working for the government. He continually refers to incriminating but confidential information that he can't release. He can never fully release any of it. But he uses slander, innuendo, and baseless accusations to discredit. Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Exactly. I've heard. Yes, someone has told me.
Yeah, exactly. All of those.
Yeah.
This is really a problem. And I guess it's a historical problem. But baseless accusations are seen as true.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because if you just keep saying it over and over again.
Everyone's like, oh yeah, this is
happening. But no one cares if it's true or not. Like no one is really looking for proof or anything.
And this was happening before Facebook.
Yeah.
This was happening before QAnon. So he continued to use slander, innuendo, and baseless accusations to discredit and ruin men and women in government. And his tactics were so successful that most people were afraid to oppose him because they thought, you know what, if I say anything, if I speak out, he's just going to turn his shit around on me and then I'm going to be the next one that gets fired. He amassed so much power so quickly that, like, he won this re-election. He made these accusations in 1950. By, like, 1953, he fucking ran this shit.
Wow.
He was, like, the king of the government in 1953. And the number, that 205 people in the State Department, kept changing.
Not surprised, because it's a lie.
Yeah. It went from 205 to like something, I can't remember exactly, but like 59 or something overnight. And everyone's like, wait a minute, I thought it was 205. And then the next thing you knew, it was like seven people or something. And no one would say anything because like the one person who said, wait, I thought it was 205. They're like, you're a
crucified.
Leftist.
Yes.
You're a leftist.
Yes.
You're out to get me. And everyone's like, that guy's a communist.
Yeah.
Fire him.
Yeah.
Oh, and it worked.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hysteria.
So like, okay, no, hysteria. I'm not going to say anything. Yeah. So, like I said before, the threat of Soviet spying wasn't completely made up. It was a real thing. There were spies. They did get these nuclear blueprints. They didn't get them from us. They got them from the Brits, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. But McCarthy's methods for rooting people out and the people he, like, specifically chose to root out, it was all a fucking hoax. It didn't do shit. He didn't root anyone out, and he didn't get anyone fired that was an actual communist or was actually working with the USSR. One historian said that they went back and cross-checked 159 people that he targeted between 1950 and 1952 before his real peak. And of 159 people, less than 10 had any actual credible ties to the
communist
Soviet government.
Oh, okay.
Or credible allegations of, like, espionage. Of those fewer than 10, they were already well-known to security officials in the government.
Of course.
Those few people.
Of course.
The same historian said, when McCarthy was right, he was not original and was only repeating charges made years earlier by others. When he was original, he was wrong. So he was just making shit up. Unless he heard it. It, like, he was in the bathroom, like, taking notes in the stall, and he heard it from somebody else. That was the only time he was ever right about somebody. But even before McCarthy himself got involved, and after McCarthy was no longer involved in these sort of communist witch hunts in the government, the main tool of officials hoping to prosecute communists was the House Un-American Activities Committee. And the HUAC was formed in 1938, specifically to investigate communist organizations that came to, not started, but really came to power during the Depression, because so many people joined the Communist Party during the Depression.
Mm.
But they also examined basically any political group that was too far left. If you were not like a super conservative.
If you weren't right of center, probably.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could be investigated by the HUAC.
When I think of liberals, I think of people who are pushing for right of center things.
Mm-hmm.
Like centrist, but right of centrist.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Like that,
especially
to me, is a liberal.
Neoliberals are like, like Joe Biden. And,
exactly.
And Nancy Pelosi.
Exactly.
And Schumer.
Yeah. Someone once called me liberal, and I'm just like,
How dare you? Progressive. Thank you.
Them is fighting words.
Like, yeah,
no,
exactly.
I'm not a Republican. What are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah. So if you were suspected by the HUAC, you would receive a subpoena. And you would have to appear before a committee, and you would be grilled about your political beliefs and your activities. And then you would be asked to provide names of other people who belong to the same political organizations as you.
Wow.
And then those other people, if you named names, those other people would also receive subpoenas.
This is, sorry to interrupt.
No.
But this is what they do in communist countries. They get people to snitch on other people just because you yourself don't want to be in trouble.
Exactly. Ugh. Literally, that's what's going on. So then these other people would be named, and then they would be pulled in. And basically, this is like a forever widening probe. They could just keep casting a wider and wider net because anyone started naming names, and they're like, okay, I got that guy, and I got that guy, and I got that guy, and then that guy's going to name this guy. And if you refuse to answer the questions, or if you refuse to name names, you could be indicted for contempt of Congress, because these are congressional hearings. And a lot of people basically saw a refusal to answer or a refusal to cooperate as proof of guilt. If you were innocent, you wouldn't have anything to hide. So you would just answer the questions. And these other people that you're naming, if they didn't have anything to hide, they'll answer the questions too. You know?
That's stupid.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Critics basically argued that these people that were going before these hearings had really broken no laws. They were just people that were left of center.
Yeah.
Or, like, even if you belong to the Communist Party,
And there's,
that's not illegal.
Go on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But supporters of the HUAC said that their efforts were justified because communism was a threat to national security. And they could say that because of the Smith Act of 1940. The Smith Act made it a criminal offense to advocate for overthrowing the government or actively working towards overthrowing the United States government. So the HUAC, basically what they were doing was rather than accusing people of any real crimes or anything that they'd actually done wrong.
Because they haven't done anything wrong.
Exactly. They were saying, you know what? A commitment to overthrowing the United States government is inherent in the doctrines of communism. So if you are a communist, you are automatically trying to overthrow the United States government. Whether you're trying or not, you are doing it. The end. End of story. Communism equals trying to overthrow the government. And that's our logic, and it's irrefutable.
Wow.
Try to prove otherwise.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Exactly. I am speechless.
As a lot of people were in the 1940s and 50s.
Like, go on. I'm just like, again, deer in headlights, like, wah?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it don't make no sense.
It don't make no sense. I love that that's contagious.
It is. I take no all sense. Of your, like, non-swear things, because I'm not going to say heaven to Betsy.
Heavens to
like,
Betsy.
It's not me. But, like, don't make no sense. Like, that feels right.
Yeah. So the first group of people that were targeted by the HUAC was obviously government employees, but their probe expanded so quickly that it went on. They went on to target labor union activists, academics.
Of course.
Smart ass people. You think you're so smart.
You think you're so big with your classes and your books.
Yeah. And your communism. And members of the entertainment industry. Today, I'm not even actually going to be talking about McCarthy himself, because McCarthyism is just sort of this term that refers to these hearings and accusations and stuff. But McCarthy was really involved in very little of McCarthyism.
Hmm.
He did the most sensational hearings and got it named after him, but there was so much of it going on. It was such a like pandemic, for lack of a better word, that like McCarthyism was rampant even when he wasn't involved at all. He really didn't have much to do with looking into Hollywood. He was really only concerned with government employees.
I mean, technically, I guess they're the ones who are close to the like levers of power. That would make sense.
Well, that was his whole thing, is like, we don't have to worry about Soviet spies if they don't know anything because they don't work for the government.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other people in our government were worried about Hollywood because they believed that A, the motion picture harbored a lot of communists, and B, they were super worried that the entertainment industry was using their influence by driving the media to indoctrinate the American public with anti-capitalist propaganda. That was where these other people were coming from, and that's why the investigations into Hollywood even started. And so even before the war and during World War II, Hollywood was like pumping out a fucking fuck ton of like super patriotic, anti-fascist, pro-war propaganda, because we were in the middle of a really big war and we were trying to get everybody to fall in line behind it. Everyone's like, no, they're pumping out Soviet propaganda and we need to be concerned about this. So in 1941, two senators led an investigation into Hollywood's role in promoting Soviet propaganda at a time when the USSR was our ally, which makes no fucking sense to me.
Yeah.
They're different, so we need to fear them even when they're our friend, basically.
Again, this is some weak shit. It's so weak. If capitalism is so great, like, why are you afraid of what your friend is doing?
Literally, the big bad wolf can come and blow it down, but it's so strong that it's unquestionable. It's so weak, this argument especially was so weak, that the lawyers who defended the studios in this investigation basically were able to just prove that these two senators who were leading the investigation were just a couple of anti-Semites who were conflating communism with Judaism, saying it's the same thing. If you're a Jewish, you're a communist.
That's
end of story. So these two senators, they lost their case, thankfully. But it was kind of like too little too late. The seeds had already been sown. And then after the war, Hollywood came up as a target once again. In 1945, the founder of a neo-fascist group called the America First Party.
It sounds like a parody of fascism.
Yeah.
Like a little too on the nose.
So this guy is running around giving speeches in LA against the alien-minded Russian Jews in Hollywood.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
What? Oh.
And then that same year, a Mississippi congressman and member of the HUAC gave a press conference saying, "One of the most dangerous plots ever instigated for the overthrow of this government has its headquarters in Hollywood, the greatest hotbed of subversive activities in the United States." And Walt Disney himself even was blaming strikes against his studio, animator strikes, writer strikes, against communism and Judaism.
He was a piece of shit.
He was a fucking piece
like
of
I'll
shit.
Like, I'll even...
Walt leave Disney it. Was, like, he deserves to be fucking burned to the ground.
He's like Henry Ford.
Totally. Disney co-founded a political action
group. It's like, let
group.
Me hear something from someone who is not an anti-Semite.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah, like, yeah. Let's hear from them. Oh, there's none of them?
But so much of this communism, this scare comes from anti-Semitism.
I have a lot to say, but I'm gonna keep it in. This is hard for me.
Yeah. So Walt Disney co-founded a political action group called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. In 1947, this group put out a pamphlet that they distributed to a bunch of film producers, telling them that they needed to avoid subtle communistic touches in their films. This pamphlet included a list of what not to do. Don't smear the free enterprise system. Don't smear industrialists. Don't smear the profit motive.
Unless they're Jewish.
Don't smear wealth. Don't glorify the collective. And don't deify the common man.
Wow.
Yeah. You can't do these things in film or it's communism. So that same year, 1947, the HUAC ramps up their investigations into Hollywood. In October, they subpoenaed 43 members of the filmmaking community and asked them questions about the spread of communism in Hollywood and the possibility that subversives were planting propaganda in American films. Of the 43 that were subpoenaed, many of the more famous names and well-known names, Gary Cooper, Walt Disney, Ronald Reagan, who was then president of the Screen Actors Guild, were specifically chosen as friendly witnesses who were going to just give the committee what it wanted to hear. Disney testified that there was a serious threat of communism in the film industry, and then he named a whole list of people that he believed were probable communists. Probably people who had organized strikes against his studio in the past.
What? But why would he do that?
Yeah. And then Reagan testified that a small group within the Screen Actors Guild were using communist-like tactics to steer union policy. So they were using, like, labor organizing tactics in a union? Years later, in her biography, Reagan's first wife, actress Jane Wyman, said that the allegations and targeting of their friends and colleagues in Hollywood were so, like, ridiculous to her. They caused so much tension in their marriage that that's largely why they divorced and why he was eventually able to marry Nancy Reagan.
Mm.
There were 19 remaining witnesses that were considered.
She was an actress too?
She was an actress. Oh, okay. They both worked in Hollywood, yeah. Mm. She was a member of the Screen Actors Guild.
So she was a communist.
Exactly. Burn her.
So if she was a witch, she, I guess, what, wouldn't float? No, if you're a witch, you float.
Yeah.
But
if you don't die, you're a witch. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Science in action.
So there were originally 43 that were subpoenaed. There were 19 remaining quote-unquote unfriendly witnesses who refused to cooperate with the HUAC. They refused to give any evidence, name any names. But of those 19, due to like illnesses and scheduling conflicts and some other circumstances, only 11 of the 19 were actually called to testify before the HUAC. One of these 11 was a German playwright named Bertolt Brecht. And he actually appeared before the committee once, gave a series of sort of like weird nonsensical answers that were like technically answering questions, but not actually giving any real answers. And then the very next day,
I love it.
He left the country and never came back. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like he saw the writing on the wall.
Exactly. Yeah. The remaining 10.
He's in there like telling haikus that he wrote.
He's like, quoth the raven.
Nevermore. It's so, like, dude, I asked you if you were a communist or not.
Exactly.
Yeah. I did not want to hear Edgar Allan Poe.
He's like, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of this stupid hearing is something quite atrocious.
Accurate.
So, yeah, he literally the next day after his first time hearing was like, okay, bye.
I love it.
Yeah. So then the remaining 10, there were 10 left over, they became known as the Hollywood 10. And one of the first questions that the hearing would ask them was, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Who fucking cares? It's not illegal, but whatever. They all 10 of them refused to answer the questions. They refused to name any names. Many of them tried to read statements, basically calling the committee's investigation unconstitutional, but the committee wouldn't let them speak. They were especially asking a lot of like yes or no questions. And if you tried to give like an elaborate answer, like, no, 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 shut your mouth. Somebody just came over and put their finger in front of
them. Someone put their finger to their lips and was like,
exactly. Yeah. Well, a few of them were able to get a couple words in edgewise, but one of them named Alva Bessie said, I will never aid or abet such a committee in its patent attempt to foster the sort of intimidation and terror that is the inevitable precursor of a fascist regime. Literally dropping some truth on this fucking committee.
I mean, fascism is this like wide thing, but like this is one of the tenets of it.
So before this investigation, these 10 men had sort of worked together a little bit in the past. They like knew each other socially, but they were far from like a unified front. They were far from like an organized group of like dissenters or subversive political, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of them were not even any longer involved with the Communist Party. What happened was a lot of people had joined the Communist Party in the 30s. And then when things kind of started to turn around in the 40s, they're like, yeah, I'm not interested anymore. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
But these same people that were saying that a desire to overthrow the government was inherent in the doctrines of communists also were saying that there was something in the doctrines of communism that you were not allowed to resign. So if you had ever been a member, you still were a member.
That's not and how...
And you still wanted to overthrow the government.
That's not how membership works.
Right? It's just so ridiculous. Some of them weren't even members of the Communist Party anymore. But the one thing that really held them together throughout this whole thing was a belief that what the HUAC was doing was not only just unconstitutional, but also completely un-American.
Yeah.
And several leading Hollywood figures, including Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, and Judy Garland, agreed with them. And they formed the Committee for the First Amendment to support the Hollywood 10 and to protest the government's targeting of the Hollywood film industry.
Mm-hmm.
However, as sort of public figures, they were really heavily pressured to back down from this. And this group quickly folded and they didn't really get to do anything. In fact, Humphrey Bogart then had to like put a public opinion piece in a magazine basically saying that he wasn't a communist himself because of his involvement, short-term involvement in this group. So the lawyers of the Hollywood 10 said, you guys should use the First Amendment as your defense. Say that through the First Amendment, you have a constitutional waiver from having to answer the questions of the HUAC's committee. But Congress disagreed. And all 10 of these men were held in contempt of Congress in a very highly publicized trial. Like, it was a media fucking circus. Years later, one of the 10, screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, actually said in an interview, as far as I was concerned, it was a completely just verdict. I had contempt for that Congress.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love him.
So all 10 of them were convicted in 1948, but they were like, you know what? It's not that big of a deal. We can appeal to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court will protect our civil liberties.
And they were actually, they were right. The Supreme Court probably would have at that time. But
because what they did was illegal.
Well,
they
had, yeah, but it was, but it wasn't. But the Supreme Court at that time was kind of progressive. But then in 1949, two Roosevelt-appointed justices died and were replaced with much more conservative justices. So in 1950, when the case finally came up before the Supreme Court was like, you know what? We're not even going to hear it. Get the fuck out of here.
Well, they kicked it back to the lower court saying, like, whatever they said is final.
Exactly. And yikes. What the lower court said was, the right of free speech is not absolute, but must yield to national interests justifiably thought to be of larger importance.
That's garbage. What? Uh-huh. So it sounds like we don't have a First Amendment, mm-hmm. like at all.
They went on to say that also applies to the right to remain silent.
What?
Yes.
Wow.
So all 10 of these men were convicted and were given a $1,000 fine, which in like 1950 was over $10,000 in today's money. And they were all given between most of them got 12 months, but a few got 6 months in federal prison.
Whoa.
While they were serving in federal prison, the former committee chairman of the HUAC, J. Parnell Thomas, was convicted of defrauding the government because he was putting fictitious workers on his payroll. I think they actually might have been his family members, if I remember correctly. And he found himself in the same federal penitentiary as the men that he had put away. They didn't all go to the same one.
Yeah.
But several of the men.
But he was the only one doing crime.
Yeah. Exactly. And he found himself in the same fucking prison as several of the Hollywood 10.
Wow. If that was me, I'm like, okay. Like, I'm like on E-Hal being like, how to make a shank.
Yeah, exactly. he's just wearing one of those ghost costumes, a sheet with a hole in the eye. I'm not here. It's not me.
I'm not me.
Yeah. These hearings by the HOAC failed to turn up any evidence at all that Hollywood was secretly pumping out communist propaganda, but things just kept getting worse anyways. So initially, the film industry, and like especially the executives, had initially offered their support of the Hollywood 10. And we're like, this is really crazy. What you guys are doing is wrong. And we support our employees and our screenwriters and whatever. Mm-hmm. One day after these 10 men were held in contempt of Congress, a big group of Hollywood execs got together at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in a secret meeting behind closed doors, and then they released a press conference and said that all 10 men would be fired and not reemployed until they were cleared of contempt charges and swore that they were not communists. They said, quote, "We will not knowingly employ a communist or a member of any party or group which advocates the overthrow of the government of the United States of America." So this was the birth of the Hollywood blacklist, because that statement is not just coming out against the Hollywood 10. You're saying literally anyone who is a communist and anyone who is a member of a subversive political party cannot be employed in Hollywood. Over the next 10 years, hundreds of writers, directors, actors, musicians, and composers and other artists were blacklisted from working in Hollywood. And scores more were bullied, targeted, and pressured by the threat of a blacklist. Even a rumor or the hint of suspicion was enough to literally ruin someone's career. And you didn't have to go before the HUAC. The HUAC didn't have to formally accuse you of anything. There was like a cottage industry of private groups that were popping up like, hey,
yeah,
I think that guy might be a communist.
This is what they do in communist countries. Like, they create this like atmosphere of fear where you're really quick to point at like your family, your mm-hmm. neighbors, like anyone who in your opinion is like stepping out of line.
Exactly.
Like I'm just guessing the propaganda was so strong.
Absolutely.
At that time,
yeah.
Where like everyone felt like anyone who didn't agree with you was a threat.
All sorts of people from all different walks of life, all different industries within Hollywood were being targeted. It could be coming from anywhere. You didn't know where it was coming from, and you just had to watch your fucking step. In 1951, the HUAC came back and launched a second investigation into the possibility of communism in Hollywood. And by this point, instead of using the First Amendment as a defense, because that had clearly failed, the people that were newly accused were now using the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination by saying, I don't have to answer your questions because I don't want to incriminate myself.
Oh, okay.
Which kept them out of jail and kept them from being held in contempt of Congress, but did not keep them from landing themselves on the Hollywood blacklist. Because of that, because you could find yourself on the blacklist just by refusing to answer questions, one third of the people that were called before the committee decided to cooperate and were naming friends and family and coworkers, even if they didn't even have any proof. They were just I need to name somebody because that's what they want.
They don't need proof. They just need the accusation, and that's enough.
Yeah. But these people that were being called before the committee were like, I don't even know what the fuck you want, but I'm just going to like start naming names arbitrarily just to get you away from me.
Yeah, that's how you get off.
Yeah. At one point, there was an actor named Lionel Stander who found himself blacklisted in 1951 because his name was mentioned in a hearing, but not as an accusation. Nobody ever accused him of anything. But somehow his name just happened to get brought up. And because his name was brought up in a hearing, that was enough for his career to just suddenly be over at the drop of a pin.
In 51?
51.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And he's like, what the fuck? Nobody even accused me of anything. And then all of a sudden I can't get a job, like out of nowhere. And then, you know, not before long, he found himself in front of the HUAC with a subpoena. And he was like, you know what? I pledge my full support in the fight against subversive activity. And he said, I know of a group of fanatics who are desperately trying to undermine the Constitution of the United States by depriving artists and others of the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness without due process of law.
Who could he be talking about? I don't know.
I can tell names and cite instances, and I am one of the first victims of it. This is a group of ex-fascists and America firsters and anti-Semites.
Ooh.
People who hate everybody.
All the tea.
Including Negroes and minority groups.
Oh, no.
And most likely themselves. These people are engaged in a conspiracy outside all the legal processes to undermine the very fundamental American concepts upon which our entire system of democracy exists.
Wow.
Boom.
Wow.
Mic drop.
Balls. The cojones.
Seriously.
Wow.
Spilling all the tea, dropping all the truth.
I like that he's like, wait, actually, I'll testify because I have a story to tell.
You don't even know what I have to say today.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Unfortunately, no one gave half a shit.
Of course.
In 1951,
they
were just getting started. No one was listening to this fucking dude. People were really worried about the possibility of getting called out themselves, and so many different groups were naming names. Even gossip columnists in Hollywood were getting in the fucking, joining in the club of like, hey, that guy might be a communist. I don't like him.
Well, you don't have to have any proof, so why not?
That guy's a bad actor. He's probably a communist.
Yeah.
Even lawyers could be targeted for investigation. Throughout the 1950s,
anyone.
Yeah. But lawyers who were defending the people that were getting called up in front of the HUAC then would find themselves targeted themselves. One lawyer who tried to defend some of the original Hollywood 10 found that the FBI was tapping his phones.
Of course.
They were opening his mail.
Mm-hmm.
There was continuous surveillance, and because of this, he actually lost a ton of clients and couldn't work anymore, and he actually committed suicide in 1959. So it's really hard to even imagine the losses and the damage that was done to these people, basically for no fucking reason, because they didn't agree with them politically, but there was no proof of anything.
Yeah.
People weren't just losing their jobs. There was so much more than that. They were losing their homes because they couldn't pay for things.
Yeah.
They were losing their sense of community. Their neighbors people would are turn running against away them. From them. Exactly. Yeah.
Again, this is like, I wish they knew about communism. Like, really? This is what happens in communist states. It's like they turn neighbors against neighbors.
Yeah.
There's this like culture of fear, and like everyone is just trying to keep themselves safe.
Yeah. Their families turn against them. A husband and wife were called before the HUAC. The husband named names, the wife refused. The husband left his wife because she refused and took their child away from her.
Wow.
And she ended up becoming an alcoholic and basically drank herself to death.
Oh, no.
So people were even losing their lives over this. Suicide was incredibly common. Alcoholism was incredibly common. Premature strokes and heart attacks were very common at this point.
It sounds like a very stressful time.
Yeah, absolutely.
To put that really mildly.
Estimating the total number of victims of McCarthyism is really tough because there were these like private groups that were operating outside the bounds of the HUAC, but still naming people as communism. And even though they weren't coming up for official hearings and government probes,
federal charges,
they were still losing their jobs. Yeah. They weren't going to prison, but they would still...
It sounds like it was enough to be suspected of it.
Exactly, yeah. Nationwide, I'm not just talking the Hollywood blacklist anymore, but nationwide, the victims of McCarthyism, we know that hundreds and hundreds of people were imprisoned. We also know that at least... This is officially 10 to 12,000 people lost their jobs over this. And that it could be much more than that, that we don't know about. In Hollywood, going back to the Hollywood blacklist, we know that for a fact, more than 300 actors, authors, screenwriters, directors, composers were denied work. It could be a much higher number. But some blacklisted actors and writers were able to find a little bit of work, especially later in the 50s as things kind of started to calm down little by little, especially people that were lesser known, you know, really famous people. It was hard. But if people didn't really know who you are, a sympathetic producer could put you in a film and it might work out for you. You could use a fake name or whatever. A little by little, some people were finding work. This was especially easier for writers because as a screenplay writer, you could either use a pseudonym or you could use a front. You could have a friend of yours who was also a screenplay writer submit a piece of work and be like, let's split the money. I wrote this, you submit it, and we'll split it. One of the most successful and best known of these people who did this was actually one of the original Hollywood 10, screenwriter Dalton Trumbo. In 1953, he wrote the screenplay for a movie called Roman Holiday with Audrey Hepburn.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. This was fronted by a screenwriter friend of his who later found himself blacklisted. So then he had to start using a pseudonym. And in 1956, he wrote a screenplay for a movie called The Brave One and submitted it under the pseudonym Robert Rich. Both of these films won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay. Both of them.
Yikes.
But because the studio system knew what was going on and knew that the screenplay writers were submitting things under pseudonyms, they were like,
of course,
we can fucking pay you like pennies and you're going to you need these pennies to pay your mortgage.
Oh, that's so fucked up.
Yeah. So he was making a teeny tiny fraction of what he was before, but he just needed to keep working.
Yeah. And it's so fucked up because he created this movie, like he produced this movie.
Two movies. Made so much money on.
Yeah. They won awards.
Yeah.
And they're just like, how does like $10
sound? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Then in 1960, director Otto Preminger publicly announced that Dalton Trumbo was the screenwriter on his upcoming film, Exodus. And by 1960, he was kind of like, you know what? Try and stop me. Nobody really gives a shit about this anymore. Fuck all y'all. You can try and stop me, but it's not going to work. I'm Otto Preminger, he was a big name. So he's like, I'm going to fucking make this movie. And if you have a problem with it, I don't care.
Oh, that's bold. Because
it's going to work. And it worked for him. Nobody gave half a shit by 1960.
Oh, okay.
And then 6 months later, the New York Times announced that Universal Pictures was going to give official screen credit to Dalton Trumbo for the movie Spartacus. He had written the movie Spartacus.
Oh, okay.
Then when Spartacus came out, his daughter, Mitzi Trumbo, said that she remembered her parents taking her to see Spartacus in the theater. She remembers like the excitement of seeing her father's name appear on screen for her first time ever seeing it on screen. Years later, she was asked if her father got emotional that night. And she said, no, but he didn't really show emotions. He was fierce and angry about the blacklist, and when it was finally broken for him, it wasn't broken for his friends. Mm. There wasn't a feeling of, oh, now it's over, because it still wasn't over for lots of people. And she was right. After the blacklist fell apart, after the blacklist didn't really have any power anymore, there were a lot of artists that really never recovered because they had lost the momentum that they had built up before the blacklist, or they were just 10 years older than before or whatever, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And a lot of these artists never worked in Hollywood again.
I'm not shocked. That's so fucked up.
Yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense. Especially for women
who
only have like, what, like 7 years before they're like, someone's like grandmother
exactly
on film. Like totally. you're not paying you're not like playing the lead even when you're like 33.
Totally.
You're like dead to Hollywood.
Literally bury her.
Yeah. Bury her.
So credit for putting Trumbo's name on the movie Spartacus usually goes to actor and producer Kirk Douglas.
Oh,
Michael Douglas's
yeah,
father.
Yeah, yeah, Michael Douglas is a terrible actor.
Don't say that out loud. A lot of people disagree with you.
He plays a rich white man, which he is. So it's like,
typecast. That's
it's
all.
Like a Matthew McConaughey who can't play a non-Texan. Well, actually, no. One time he played a man from Louisiana.
The range.
The range. Yes. Yes.
So he has received a ton, Kirk Douglas has received a ton of praise for breaking the blacklist. Single-handedly.
Shut up.
He won a 1991 award from the Writers Guild of America for a singular act of courage. A lot of people have a lot to say about that.
I now do too. Yes, yeah. I'm like standing in line like, I've got something to say.
I've seen the receipts. I mean, know of the receipts.
I've just heard about this 15 minutes ago, but I have a statement.
I'm here in line with a receipt. Yeah, the reality is the blacklist was already starting to crumble. By 1960, it was like the beginning of the end. A lot of lesser known people in Hollywood were doing what they needed to do to keep working, to keep their heads above water. And a lot of other people in Hollywood who were not part of the probes from the HUAC were doing what they could to keep their friends' heads above water and find work for their friends. There were a lot of these sort of like little acts of courage from lesser known artists that I have a ton of them that I could talk about, but I cut them from my story for time because I could fucking talk about this for hours and hours.
I mean, it went on for decades.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not a small story at all.
But there were even a lot of really big names that were targeted by the blacklist. And some people were just sort of like harassed a little bit, but never made it before the HUAC, like Lucille Ball.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then some people were blacklisted, like Lena Horne never worked again. Well, she did work again later, but once the blacklist was over, some people like Charlie Chaplin and Orson Welles actually moved out of the country and moved to Europe so that they could continue their careers because they were blacklisted.
Really? Yeah. Charlie Chaplin and Orson Welles had to move?
Move to Europe, yeah.
They had to act like they were black and leave to have like freedom?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
In recent years, the Writers Guild has actually been going back and trying to correct the screen credit that is on a lot of older films from the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know what? This was a pseudonym. This was a front. Let's give the actual writer of this film credit.
And maybe money?
Well, a lot of them are probably dead by this
point. But still family?
I can't say because I don't know about that for sure.
Okay.
I think they're not the ones that would owe that money in the first place, the Writers Guild. It's not their
responsibility to pay reparations for
these things, but they're at least trying to get screen credit.
It would be the studio,
yes. Yeah, exactly. And then in 2015, there was a film made called Trumbo about Dalton Trumbo and about the Hollywood 10. And it's really, really good. If this story interests you, the movie Trumbo, it's on Netflix.
Oh, okay. I'm going to watch this. It's really good.
Yeah. It's very compelling. But thankfully, the decline of McCarthyism, the decline of the HUAC's reach and relevancy was not limited to Hollywood. After 1960, the idea just wasn't popular anymore. People didn't give a shit anymore, for the most part. Obviously, there were still some people who were still drinking that Kool-Aid. But for the most part, a lot of people were like, you know what? I don't give a shit about the fucking HUAC. I don't give a shit about Joseph McCarthy because he's long gone by this point.
Yeah.
Even Truman himself came out and was like, this is un-American. Yeah.
Fuck him.
Yeah.
Seriously, fuck him.
And the Supreme Court was also becoming less conservative and had started overturning decisions that basically caused an official end of the McCarthy era.
This was early 60s?
Like late 50s, early 60s, yeah.
Hmm.
McCarthy himself had actually found himself censured by the United States Senate in 1954 because he, they said he was abusing his power because in 1954 he actually tried to go after the U.S. Army. He got himself into some trouble.
For being communist?
I mean, yes, exactly.
Stop it.
He was on some hubris. He like...
But...
His head.
I mean, I guess I was about to ask, like, what facts did he have? But who cares?
He didn't have a fact from the very beginning. And his head just kept getting.
In 1954, his head would not have fit into this room.
He thought he could go after the army?
It backfired. That was finally when people were like, you know what? Fuck this dude.
Why not the president? Why not?
Seriously, yeah.
You know, let's just go there.
I think I might revisit this part of the story.
I think later you have on. To. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to get to it this season because I have so much more to talk about. Other stories to talk about, but I think season 4, we may revisit Joseph McCarthy.
You must.
But thankfully, he died a broken man in 1957.
R.I.P.
Today, I'm going to just end by saying today, a lot of people look back on the McCarthy era and McCarthyism as having very little to do with actually rooting out people with ties to the USSR.
I mean, duh, girl.
And just basically say that it was a tool used by the right to discredit and ruin anyone with political beliefs that they didn't like. Especially when after people who were opposed to nuclear testing and who pushed too hard for civil rights.
Hmm.
Surprise.
Wait,
I bet you
racism?
Didn't see that one coming. Yeah.
But how?
Yes. So that's my intro to McCarthyism.
That's a good overview. And that was illuminating. And I learned a lot. And I am, you know, really upset. I held my tongue. I'm like, just channel your anger into drinking this gin, which is what I did because
look at that. Wow. That was a big ass glass of gin and it is all gone.
Totally gone.
I drank my juice.
I drank my medicine and it's now done. But yeah, that was a really good story. Really good story.
Oh, it was really hard for me to write that because there are so many ways. There are like, so many directions
I'm
you can
impressed
go with McCarthyism.
You could condense it down into one story.
Stephanie knows this already, but I was texting her originally a few days ago when I was first kind of getting my story together. I was like, oh my God. Like, I can't even tell you the size of the story and how...
He had all the words.
Every word
like,
in
all
the
of the
language.
Words, y'all.
But so many... Like, McCarthyism points towards so many other things that are going on currently and have gone on since the 50s. Like, we have just kept revisiting this over and over and over, and nobody has learned a goddamn thing.
Facts.
Yeah.
Sadly. It's so upsetting to hear all of these, like, baseless claims being taken as fact. But when, then you realize, like, oh, it's 2020, and, like, that's kind of, like, the wave that we're on. Like, you don't need to have facts. You could just say that things are, you know, corrupt, and, like, they said this.
Exactly.
And
but it's easy to be like, oh, no, back in the 50s, the government actually functioned properly. No, it didn't.
And seriously, and this is why this story is so important, because I think we have a lot of just, like, nostalgia. About like the past,
especially
when
about
things
the 50s.
Were better.
People love to think of the
people
50s
love
as the good
the
50s. Old days.
Yeah, and it's just like the good old days for who? Like those in power lying?
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Right, straight, white, rich, right wing men.
Yeah, just lying about things and like knowingly lying.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
It's hard to say because communism was such a boogeyman, but it seems like there were so little real facts about anything.
They didn't root out shit.
Anyways, but our drinks
literally couldn't be more empty.
My drink is just limes. I have a straw with some limes.
They're like dehydrated. You've sucked all the moisture out of those limes.
So, yeah, my drink is empty, so I guess we're done. America's history is juicy. We just add gin and some soda water and some limes. We say click, click.
Uh-huh. We say click, click to you.
Does our audience know that I can't make that sound?
I think they do by this point. Yes.
Shameful. I can make it. I just don't want to.
That's it. Click, click.
So thank you. Thank you so much. For listening to Beyond Reproach, this has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tex Lerzel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, our sound engineer, our podfather. We cannot do this without him.
True story.
He's our Lord and Savior. Our Lord.
Lord.
I said Lord.
What's that?
What does that mean? Our Lord and Savior.
Yes.
Thank you, thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for putting up with us after we have consumed approximately too much gin.
Speak for yourself.
Approximately several ounces of gin. All right.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.